Scott Ritter is a former Marine Intelligence Officer who served as a Chief UN Weapons Inspector in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. A ballistic missile technology expert, Ritter is one of the few officials with a working knowledge of Saddam Hussein's weapons systems to publicly and aggressively oppose the Bush administration's disastrous war in Iraq before the invasion in March 2003. His latest book is titled Iraq Confidential, The Untold Story of America's Intelligence Conspiracy. Scott Ritter delivered an address in New Haven, Connecticut on September the 17th, 2005, titled Parallel Deceptions, The Bush Agenda for War in Iraq and Iran. In this talk, Ritter focused on the lies and distortions about weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's false connection with 9/11, used by President Bush to gain support for his war in Iraq. Ritter also warns that a similar propaganda campaign is now underway to justify a future military confrontation with Iran over its nuclear capability. Hear now Scott Ritter's address, followed by a question and answer session with the New Haven audience.
The organizations that sponsored this event today are not organizations that I would have been a member of when I was in college and after I graduated in college and I joined the Marine Corps. It doesn't mean that I'm against them. It just means that that wasn't the sphere that I operated in. And yet here we are today. We've come together not because we call ourselves Republicans or we call ourselves Democrats or we call ourselves conservatives or we call ourselves liberals. We're coming today because we call ourselves Americans. And we're united in a desire that our country operate in full accordance with the promise and the vision that was set forth in a document. And there's another event that just recently occurred, either yesterday or today. It might have been yesterday, I believe, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution of the United States, a document that defines who we are and what we are as a people. It's not a perfect document. We're not a perfect country. We're an evolving country. Anybody who thinks the Constitution is a perfect document only needs to reflect on American history as we spent several hundred years fixing some fundamental flaws that existed in that Constitution. But you know what? The Constitution is a great document because it did serve as the foundation of the rule of law that governs how we, the people of the United States of America, words that come from the preamble in the Constitution, how we, the people of the United States of America, exist, not only with ourselves, but with the rest of the world. And it is tragically ironic that today is the, I think, third anniversary of the Bush administration's bringing into fruition, implementation, the national security strategy of the United States, which not only represents a frontal assault on basic human decency, but also international law, and with it, the Constitution of the United States of America, a document that the 142,000 American service members who serve in Iraq today all took an oath to uphold and defend with their lives, if necessary. We got Americans dying in Iraq. And that might be another thing that distinguishes me from many of the people in the audience today. I'm not a pacifist. I don't believe in it. I'm a warrior. And I believe that there comes a time and a place in which American service members are going to be called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice in defense of the Constitution of the United States of America. It's the willingness of our fellow Americans to make this sacrifice that has allowed our country to survive, not perfectly, but to survive for the two centuries that we've graced the earth. And I take the sacrifice, this issue of sacrifice, very seriously. I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America and all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I took that oath seriously. I went to war for my country, and I was willing to put my life on the line for my country. Today, we have a situation in Iraq where hundreds of thousands of American youth, of American citizens, of American patriots have cycled through that country over the course of the last several years. Over 1,880 of them have given their lives. Thousands more have been forever maimed by this war, either physically, emotionally, mentally. These are the harsh realities of war. I say I'm a warrior. I say I'm not a pacifist, but I do not love war. I hate war. I hate war with every ounce of my body because war is the most horrible thing that mankind can do to mankind. War is about one thing and one thing only, and that's killing. Killing human lives. Destroying that which sustains human life. And it is truly a sad state of affairs when in the course of human events we see fit to wage war against one another. So from this horror, we say there are those who will sacrifice, those who will make the sacrifice. Now, a lot of people blame what's going on in Iraq on the soldiers, on the sailors, on the airmen, on the Marines. They say, hey, they volunteered, all professional military. You know, they knew what they were getting into. It's their fault. Well, you know, some did volunteer for a variety of reasons. All of them volunteered for a variety of reasons, but they volunteered to serve. Their motivations of service might be different, economic, patriotic, whatever. But they served. People condemn this. Some people condemn this service by noting that the war in Iraq is an illegitimate war. I myself view this war as an illegal war, that we're engaged in an illegitimate occupation of Iraq that violates international law and therefore opens up certain leaders of our country to charges of crimes against humanity, war crimes. But I'm not someone who extends these crimes down to the service members in Iraq. They're obeying their orders. It's not the duty and responsibility of the soldiers, the sailors, and the airmen to discuss and debate the constitutionality of decisions made by the President of the United States. When you join the military, you're prepared to wage war, and you need to be focused on that job if you are to survive in combat situations. When I went to war, I wasn't too concerned about discussions taking place in the United Nations or discussions in the Congress of the United States. I was worried about what the enemy was doing over the horizon and how my Marines were going to get prepared to close with and destroy that enemy through firepower and maneuver. That's what war is about. It's not the service members' responsibility to discuss the constitutionality. It's we, the people of the United States of America. They have put forward the willingness to make the ultimate sacrifice in our defense. And what we owe it to them is to ensure that before we call upon them to make that sacrifice, that we have done everything to ensure that it is a sacrifice or it is a cause worthy of that sacrifice. And ladies and gentlemen, what's going on today in Iraq is not such a cause at all. And I say this because I'm getting ready now to speak harshly about the involvement of the United States of America in Iraq. But I don't want anybody in this audience or anybody who might listen to these words later on to misconstrue them as me speaking out against the troops. It's the furthest thing from it. I'm speaking out against the policies that are needlessly sacrificing our troops. And when we talk about Iraq and we talk about what's going on in Iraq today, and let me be clear, what's going on in Iraq today is a nightmare. But as bad as the situation is today, tomorrow is going to be worse. And the day after tomorrow is going to be worse than that. And it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. Today is the best day we're going to have in Iraq. Which is why I say, when someone says, well, then what do we do? Well, if today's the best day, and tomorrow's going to get worse, why don't we get out on the best day? Why do we have to wait for it to get worse? But some people say, well, We're there. It doesn't matter what the justification of this war is. We're there. That old Colin Powell term or saying that he throws out there, you know, we broke it, we own it. Well, we broke Iraq. You know, a lot of people make the argument that we now own it, and therefore we are responsible for fixing the situation in Iraq. Fine. So we're going to be building something in Iraq. Let me bring up a couple analogies. The first one is when we talk about the presence of American troops in Iraq. I liken Iraq to a nation on fire, just burning from top to bottom, left to right, east to west. And the fuel that feeds that fire is the presence of American soldiers. If you're going to put out that fire, you got to separate the fuel from the flame. You got to get the boys and girls home now, and only then will the flame begin to burn down. As long as we have American troops in Iraq, that flame's just going to keep burning hotter and hotter and hotter, and it's going to consume more and more and more. When we talk about building something new in Iraq, what's the basis of any construction project? It's the foundation. You can't speak of building up until you've built a solid foundation. And ladies and gentlemen, the foundation of America's involvement in Iraq is as corrupt as it can possibly get. We went to war on a lie. We went to war in violation of international law. We went to war in violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. We went to war against the better wishes of our allies around the world. It is a corrupt foundation that defines our occupation. I'm starting to sound like Jesse Jackson. But I didn't mean that for that to rhyme, but I like that. But so it's a nothing we build is going to last. You're building on a corrupt foundation. Anything we build will collapse. Will collapse. There is no chance, none whatsoever, of anything we do in Iraq today succeeding because of the corruption of our involvement, our initial involvement. So if we want to fix the problem in Iraq, we need to disengage and then re-engage on a foundation of legitimacy, on a foundation of integrity, on a foundation that is compliant with the laws of the land, both in terms of international law, that which dictates how we as a people interact with the other people of the world, but also the Constitution that we ask the men and women of the United States of America, not that we ask that they took an oath to give their lives in defense of Article 6 of that Constitution. And I would advise every American out there to start reading the Constitution and living the Constitution. But Article 6 says that when we have entered into a treaty or international agreement that has been ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, that is the supreme law of the land, and we have signed the United Nations Charter, and we are bound by the United Nations Charter. And yet, thanks to the Bush administration in 2002, they passed the new National Security Strategy of the United States of America, which is a total deviation from the rule of international law as set forth by the Charter of the United Nations, which therefore makes this policy a deviation from the Constitution itself. This is wrong. But a lot of Americans don't understand this. So we operate under the assumption that Iraq was a mistake. Yeah, it's bad, but I mean, why are you getting all riled up? It's a mistake. I mean, after all, we've got five committees, commissions, and other boards that have met, three here in the United States, two in the United Kingdom, that have discussed the lead up to the war, the intelligence failure. And they say there was no deliberate deception going on. It was just a mistake. You have the CIA's own report, the ISG, the Iraq Survey Group, David Kaye's report, later certified by Charles Dolfer. So we got it all wrong. We got it all wrong. You got the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. It says there was no politicization of intelligence. We just got it wrong. You got the president's own commission, which we know is going to tell the truth. And they say, we got it wrong. Then you got the British, the Hunt Inquiry, and the Butler Report. And they say, we got it wrong. So you got five reports that the media parrots to the public, leading to the perception by the public that this was just a mistake. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it wasn't a mistake. Iraq was a product of a decade of deliberate deception undertaken by the government of the United States and the CIA to deceive the American people about what was really going on in Iraq. You see, the policy of the United States vis-a-vis Iraq was never disarmament. That's the first fact you've got to put in your brain. We never were trying to disarm Iraq. We have always been trying to remove Saddam Hussein from power. In October 1990, in the lead-up to the first Gulf War, President George Herbert Walker Bush had a daunting task. A problem of his own making, you see. They had this guy named Saddam Hussein, for a decade under Ronald Reagan, was an ally of the United States to hold back Islamic fundamentalism coming out of Iran. And we supported this dictator named Saddam Hussein. So much so that it became a critical regional ally. In the spring of 1990, George Herbert Walker Bush dispatched a senior senatorial delegation led by a senior Republican senator named Bob Dole, who flew to Iraq, met up with Saddam Hussein in presidential palace in Mosul, and embraced Saddam, calling him a true friend of the American people. A true friend of the American people. Well, that true friend turned around and invaded Kuwait in August 1990, and the United States determined that that invasion could not stand, and now we were going to confront a true friend of the American people with military force. How do you explain to the American people why we're going to go to war against our true friend? Well, you've got to engage in the politics of demonization. You see, you don't want to discuss the complexities of the geopolitical situation going on in the Middle East, because you'd have to stand before the American people and actually make them think. You'd have to put out details, and some of it would be self-contradictory, and it would be very complex, and it would take a long time, and the media would get bored and go home. I had a general once tell me, when you're explaining, you're losing. And that's a dictum that holds true to politicians, too. They don't want to explain anything to their constituents. They want to come out with gross oversimplifications, black and white differentiations. So we had a true friend, but he's not our true friend anymore. What is he? Why, he's the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. When you call somebody Adolf Hitler, you sort of limit your possibilities now and how you're going to deal with them. So no longer we can say he's a partial friend or a slight friend. He's now the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. He's the personification of evil. This is Saddam Hussein. Someone who is so bad that he requires Nuremberg-like retribution. Once again, we've set the standard. The president, through his rhetoric, has trapped himself. Because we called Saddam Adolf Hitler, which means we can never negotiate with this man. We have one policy option only, which is to remove Saddam from power. Not just Saddam, but his regime, through Nuremberg-like retribution. The Nuremberg trials at the aftermath of the Second World War were alluded to as the solution for Iraq. While the president was stirring up war fever in America, though, we had to deal with international law. And the rest of the world, they weren't frothing at the mouth about the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. They were saying he invaded Kuwait, and we need to liberate Kuwait. And they passed a resolution under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter that said the international community can use military force to achieve the liberation of Kuwait. That's the war I fought in. We liberated Kuwait. And once we finished with our task, we came home. We had big parades in New York City and Washington, D.C. We declared it a great victory, restored the pride and prestige in the American military that was lost in Vietnam, and the American people are applauding, but in the back of their mind, they're going, well, wait a minute, where's that Nuremberg thing? You called him Hitler. And when I look at the map and all that, Saddam still lives in Baghdad. The president had a political problem, ladies and gentlemen, a political problem. Not just the president, but every member of Congress who supported the war. And voted for the war. Because they voted for a war, although it was defined internationally as liberation of Kuwait, it was defined to the American people as getting rid of a man that was likened to the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. The president's problem was political. Notice I emphasize the political nature of this. I'm not talking about Saddam Hussein posing a threat to international peace and security. We just kicked the holy beep out of his army. He didn't have an army left. It was destroyed. We flattened his cities. We destroyed his economy through military action and economic sanctions imposed in August of 1990 when he invaded Kuwait. Saddam posed a threat to no one except certain segments of his own society in 1991. But the president needed Saddam gone because that's what he told the American people. They didn't want to drive to Baghdad because that would be too complicated, but the CIA came up with an easy solution. They said, Mr. President, wait 6 months. And Saddam will collapse of his own volition. He's not going to last. His economy's gone. His military's gone. Civil unrest will rise up. And Saddam is out of there. You just need to keep squeezing him economically. Can't be allowed to rebuild. Well, how do you squeeze economically? Economic sanctions that were imposed in August of 1990. The problem, though, is that these sanctions were linked to Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. We just fought a war and kicked the Iraqis out of Kuwait. There's no more justification for economic sanctions against Iraq. You need a new justification, which was weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biologic weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles, which Iraq had at that time. Prior to the war, we didn't view Iraq's weapons of mass destruction as posing a threat to international peace and security. We didn't view them as posing a threat to the United States of America, because they didn't. They were sort of amateur programs, little, you know, high school science programs. Didn't accomplish much. Their nuclear program might have been able to reach fruition in a number of years. A lot of people think it never would have because it just wasn't that good. They weren't that good at doing what they did. But now we turn their weapons of mass destruction into the threat against international peace and security. We got to the Security Council and we got a new resolution which said Iraq must be disarmed 100% of its weapons of mass destruction, and until Iraq is found to be in compliance, economic sanctions will be continued, linked to this disarmament. But notice the emphasis I'm placing. I'm not saying the Bush administration wanted to disarm Iraq. No, the Bush administration wants to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The vehicle for getting rid of Saddam Hussein is pressure brought about by economic sanctions. And the only use disarmament has is to legitimize the continuation of economic sanctions. That's what it was all about. So you hype up the threat. And it's easy to hype it up because Saddam's not a good guy to begin with. And he does have these weapons. He has chemical weapons, biological weapons. He's working on a nuclear weapons program. And he has long-range ballistic missiles. So inspectors go in. They engage in the process of disarmament. It's very complicated up front. The Iraqis don't cooperate. They lie. The inspectors get obstructed. The inspectors redouble their efforts. And by 1996, thanks to the hard work of the inspectors, 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were accounted for. 100% of Iraq's industrial infrastructure was monitored by the most intrusive and technologically advanced on-site inspection regime in the history of arms control. Certain element of Iraq's weapons program that was unaccounted for. Some of their munitions. You know, because the Iraqis, they held back a lot early on. They didn't give it all up to us. And then when the inspectors started to get close, they panicked like a drug dealer with drugs. They flushed the drugs down the toilet. The Iraqis blew up their weapons and buried them in the desert. And then continued to deny we never had any weapons. But then the inspectors started to uncover the reality that they did have weapons, so the Iraqis had to admit, like a drug dealer, yeah, well, we had the drugs, but we flushed them down the toilet. The Iraqis said, yeah, we had the weapons, but we blew them up. But now we have to go find the weapons. And like a narcotics agent who finds, let's say there were 10 bags, you only found 8 bags of drugs in the sewage system, you turn to the Iraqis and say, where are the other 2 bags? The Iraqis said, well, we flushed all 10 down there. I don't know what happened to them. I mean, something happened to them, but... Well, once you lie to the drug deal, the narcotics agents, they're only going to give you credit for 8. They're going to assume that the other 2 are hidden someplace, even though they don't have any evidence that they're hidden. They just don't trust the drug dealer. Once the Iraqis lie to the inspectors, we have to assume that which we can't find is being hidden. We can't give them the benefit of the doubt. So you create the myth of missing weapons of mass destruction that we have to start searching for. How do you prove a negative, though? We didn't have any evidence that these things existed today. We knew they existed once. The Iraqis say they destroyed it. We can't confirm that the Iraqis destroyed everything, so we assume that the weapons existed. But there's no evidence to actually back up the claims that they do exist. So every inspection we go on looking for these missing weapons will result inevitably in a negative result. A negative result. But what does that mean? That they don't have the weapons, or they're really, really good at hiding them? And so the naysayers will say they're really, really good at hiding them. So now we've got to dig even deeper into the process. We can't just look for the weapons. We have to examine the process that could be used, not is used, but could be used to hide the weapons. So we started examining the Iraqi government, security institutions, etc. Now, this creates a problem initially, because as we start to examine these methodologies, it becomes very clear that the Iraqis are probably disarmed. And by 1996, the weapons inspectors are very close to coming out publicly and saying there are no weapons of mass destruction. We tried 1992 in ballistic missiles. I wrote a report that went to the director of the CIA that said all missiles are accounted for. There's nothing left. The director of the CIA called in my boss, Rolf Acacius, and said, "Nah, there's 200 missiles out there." I said, "Well, where'd you get that number? We got zero. Where'd you get 200? That's the number we have. We believe they're out there. We believe the Iraqis lied to you." Well, it's physically impossible for them to have 200 missiles. They just don't, you know, water a missile tree and missiles grow. They have to come from someplace, and we've exhausted that. Nope, 200 missiles. We said, well, you got that number. Where's the intelligence? So gradually, the CIA started producing some intelligence about missiles buried in the desert, buried under rivers, dug into mountains. So we built a special helicopter with ground-penetrating radar on it, and we flew around Iraq for a couple months looking at all these places, and we found nothing. There are no buried missiles. Went back to the CIA and said, all the missiles are accounted for. The CIA came back and said, nope, there's 12 to 16 missiles, and that number will never change, ever. In the lead up to the Gulf War in 2003, the Iraqis were claimed to have 12 to 16 Scud missiles. The CIA was honest about one thing. That number never changed. But it was a number that wasn't based in reality. The CIA knew there were no missiles. The same thing holds true in chemical weapons and in biological weapons and in nuclear weapons. The CIA knew as early as 1992 in all four categories that Iraq was fundamentally disarmed. But the CIA's job wasn't to disarm Iraq. In October 1992, the CIA was given a task by the President of the United States to overthrow Saddam Hussein. A covert finding was signed by President George Herbert Walker Bush saying that the CIA's primary mission in Iraq is to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Weapons inspections were only useful insofar as they sustained economic sanctions to contain Saddam, until which time the CIA could get rid of the madman. So what happens now when weapons inspectors start to figure out there are no weapons and they're going to go public? Is that a conclusion the CIA is going to embrace or reject? Our success as inspectors became a threat to the national security of the United States of America. And the United States of America, starting in 1996, worked to aggressively undermine the credibility and legitimacy and integrity of the inspection operation. In the summer of 1996, the CIA used the weapons inspection process as a vehicle to spy on Saddam Hussein in an effort to launch a coup d'etat. It failed. But the Iraqis were able to link CIA efforts with the inspection teams and forever would never again trust the weapons inspectors in their work in Iraq. How can you trust an inspector when he's not inspecting for weapons of mass destruction but trying to kill your president? They destroyed the credibility of the inspections. What was the purpose of this? To create the perception among the American public of a non-compliant Iraq. That's the sole purpose of it. The weapons inspectors were on the verge of deeming Iraq to be disarmed. The CIA couldn't have that, so they orchestrate events that create the perception of a non-compliant Iraq. Perceptions that are parroted by the media and then enhanced by the government through leaking of unsustained allegations about the existence of massive quantities of chemical weapons, massive stockpiles of biological weapons. And the American public bought into it at face value. At face value. That's why there was no big debate about whether or not there was a legitimacy to the Bush administration's claim that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction in the lead up to the 2003 invasion. When the Senate had its hearings in the summer of 2002, they had one day of testimony about weapons of mass destruction. They brought in Richard Butler, my former boss, an Australian, who said, yeah, they got him. Now, he's the head of the UN weapons inspection teams. Who's going to question him? He says they got him. Richard Butler says they're here. They brought in Khidir Hamza, a defector, nuclear guy. Said, yep, they got a nuclear weapons program. Hamza was identified in 1995 as a fraud by the weapons inspectors, a liar. The CIA knew that he was peddling false documents in 1995, 1996. And yet the Senate, who was aware of both the inspectors' feelings about Hamza and the CIA's assessments, allowed Hamza to come forward and testify in televised testimony, and the American people sat there and said, senior Iraqi nuclear weapons designer says there are nuclear weapons in Iraq. David Kay was brought in, a paid consultant of the CIA whose sole job after he left the UN weapons inspection process was to go on TV and talk about the existence of weapons that he knew didn't exist. And then they ended the debate. They didn't allow any contrary opinion to come in, and the American public was left there saying, there must be weapons in Iraq. And we went to war based on that perception. Well, today we know there were no weapons. And you'd think the American public would have learned its lesson. Always question the government when it comes to issues of war. Why are we going to war? Question the government about the information they put out there to sustain any notion of justification. Question the government about the fundamental underlying foundation of its policy. Why were we going to war with Iraq? Ladies and gentlemen, we went to war in Iraq for a number of reasons, none of which had to do with the national security of the United States of America. We went to war in Iraq because of a domestic political problem that George Herbert Walker Bush had in 1991, a problem that was inherited by Bill Clinton, a problem that Congress couldn't fix because Congress had bought into the notion of Saddam Hussein being Adolf Hitler. If Saddam Hussein's Adolf Hitler, how can you possibly talk about resolving the situation with Iraq? Bill Clinton said, I'm a good Southern Baptist Christian. I believe in deathbed conversions, and I think we can do business with Saddam Hussein if we just get him to confess his sins and come on over to the good side. Congress, Democrats, Republicans alike said, no, we told our constituents that Saddam's Hitler. We can't change that. If you're explaining, you're losing. We don't want to explain anything. We're going to stick with the simplistic notion of Saddam is evil. We're going to contain him. So now Clinton had a political problem because containment wasn't working. Sanctions were killing innocent Iraqis. Clinton had to ratchet up the process, make the CIA behave even more aggressively to get rid of Saddam. And yet he failed. His failure became a card for the Republican Party, in particular the neoconservatives, who used the American failure to stand up to the Hitler-like Saddam as a frontal attack on the national security of the United States. And therefore, they articulated a policy of aggressive confrontation of Saddam. And this aggressive confrontation served as the kernel around which these neoconservatives built their larger policy of global domination. Saddam Hussein was just one of many bad people out there, according to neoconservatives. Regime change had become the heart of what we needed to do as Americans to solve the world's ills. We have bad countries out there, North Korea, Iran, Iraq. Iraq was a model of how the United States was going to start dealing with the Iranian and North Korean problems, the Syrian problems, etc. And it is a model, but it's a model of deception. It's a model of deceit. It's a model that has the government of the United States of America lying to the American people. It's a model that has the media of the United States of America, mainstream media, parroting in an unchallenged way anything the government says. It's a system that has the media of the United States discount in a very dismissive fashion expert testimony by weapons inspectors who served in Iraq for 7 years running the intelligence programs. And nobody stood up and protested with a handful. I mean, I'm sure there's exceptions in this audience, but I mean, if you go out and do a canvas of New Haven, you do a canvas of Connecticut, you do a canvas of America, the majority of the American people either sat by idly and ignorant or believed what they were being told. Very few people stepped down and said, wait a minute, I got a question. It is a model, and it's a model that's being repeated today. Just as nobody would stand up and oppose the Bush administration's articulation about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein, because remember, Bush has simplified things down quite a bit. You're either with me or against me. I want to take out Saddam. You're either with me or you're with Saddam. Now, who wanted to be accused of being on Saddam's side? No one. I wasn't on Saddam's side. I was on the side of the rule of law. I was on the side of enforcing the rule of law. I was on the side of letting the weapons inspectors do what they need. I wasn't on Saddam's side, but my position became characterized as pro-Saddam. Now we have a situation in Iran. Remember, what's important to remember about Iran is that a lot of people here say Iraq and Iran. They're the same thing in the minds of the Bush administration. The Bush administration speaks of regional transformation. Regime change in Iraq, in Iran, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, and in Egypt. Regional transformation is the cornerstone of our Middle East policy. Iran is next, the Bush administration has said. Its policy in Iran is regime change. Just like with Iraq, when the Bush administration said our policy on Iraq is regime change in the summer of 2002, and we need to do what? Everybody should know this one. You should be able to shout it out. Fix intelligence around the policy. The policy is regime change. So let's make up an excuse to get regime change. How do we sell regime change to the American people? Create a threat. The threat in Iraq's case was weapons of mass destruction. It's a threat that they're recreating vis-a-vis Iran. But it's even a more dire threat. So the Iraqi one was complicated. So they've really simplified the Iranian threat. Nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons. What was the most effective sales pitch the Bush administration used for the Iraq war? We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. It's the same logic they're using now with Iran. They say Iran has a nuclear weapons program. The majority of the American people, according to a poll taken last spring, believe Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Now, a lot of people are tired of war in America. So when you say, do you support a war with Iran? Not so many people jump up and say it, although I think it was like 56% said, if Iran has a nuclear weapons program, we're justified in using military force to get rid of it. But you know what a majority of American people, up to around 76%, support? UN sanctions against Iran. Economic sanctions. Now, this is an important part of this equation here, because what happens if the United States builds its whole policy of confronting Iran based on the notion of economic sanctions, and we try to take the sanctions or the case to the Security Council, and the Russians and the Chinese veto it, say no? We've now boxed ourselves into a corner where we have no outlet, because the only reason to push for sanctions is to stop Iran from having a nuclear weapons program that we said we should go to war to prevent. And if we force ourselves into this sanctions-based diplomacy that is bound to fail because the Russians and Chinese have already said, we're not going with it, this diplomatic option is really a wolf in sheep's clothing. It's a disguise for war. And this is the policy of the Bush administration. They are seeking to shift the debate about Iran's nuclear program from Vienna to the Security Council in New York, where they were aggressively pushed for the imposition of economic sanctions. And when that fails, as it will, that other trump card gets played. You know, that nice guy we have as our ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. Why do you think the Bush administration pushed so hard to get John Bolton in place? Because John Bolton has a script, and he's going to play it right to the letter. If the Security Council does not impose sanctions, then the Security Council has failed in its responsibility to protect international peace and security, and moreover, to protect the security of the United States. The United States will never allow its security policies to be held hostage by the United Nations. This is a theme that's been played over and over and over again, and the majority of the American public has said, we agree with that. So when Bolton articulates this and Bush articulates it, what's going to happen? We're going to go to war against Iran. And it's inevitable, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to go to war against Iran. Why? The American people are going to be told because of a nuclear weapons program. But like the Iraqi program, it simply doesn't exist. See, the Iraqis actually had a weapons program. The weapons inspectors got rid of it. The Iranians have a nuclear energy program. The Bush administration has said that the mere existence of this nuclear energy program is proof positive that Iran is seeking a nuclear weapons program, because there is no excuse for a nation awash in a sea of hydrocarbons, oil, to be seeking a nuclear energy program. It doesn't make any sense. So if it doesn't make any sense, what are they really doing? It's a front for nuclear weapons. And most Americans go, yeah, that makes sense, until you read the fine print. 1976, the Shah of Iran submits a proposal to the United States of America saying that it is in the strategic interest of Iran, a modern industrial state, to diversify its energy needs. It cannot be held hostage to a single source of energy. The oil-based economy of Iran is vulnerable. Straits of Hormuz can be shut down. Oil fields can be bombed. Refineries can be bombed. Iran needs to create backup capability in the form of nuclear energy. Not just reactors, but the complete cycle, fuel cycle, producing and enriching its own fuel, reprocessing its own fuel. And you know what the United States government said in 1976? Yes, this makes perfect sense. Who was Secretary of Defense? Donald Rumsfeld. Who is the White House Chief of Staff? Dick Cheney. In 1976, it said it made perfect sense for the Iranians to have a nuclear energy program with the full cycle. Today, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, says there can be no excuse for the Iranians wanting to have a nuclear energy program except to be as a front for nuclear weapons. Now, they've created this picture, and a lot of Americans buy into it. They say, well, wait a minute, if they do have a nuclear energy program, how do we know they're not making nuclear weapons? Well, here's another part of the debate that the American people don't catch on to. You know, there's a lot of talk right now about shifting the debate from Vienna, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to the Security Council, where the Security Council is going to be asked to impose sanctions. But remember that little thing I talked about, the rule of law? Can anybody here tell me what law Iraq's broken, or Iran's broken? Not one. Iran, in developing its nuclear energy program, is operating in full compliance with every article of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran has declared the total extent of its program and has opened up this program to inspection by International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors. Iran's violated no law. Now, it's very difficult to have a case brought to the Security Council where you're going to impose economic sanctions under Chapter 7 of the Charter. Chapter 7 speaks of imposing, of the Security Council acting when there a threat exists to international peace and security. But how can a threat exist when Iran is obeying the very law the Charter is supposed to be representing? Iran has violated no law, not one law. You can't make a nuclear weapons program out of a nuclear energy program that's fully monitored by international weapons inspectors. And the IAEA inspectors are in Iran as we speak, monitoring the program. But we don't talk about that here in America. We just talk about the Iranian nuclear energy program. We have the president say that we've told the Iranians to shut down, and they haven't, therefore they pose a threat. But we can't order Iran to shut down. Iran's complying with the law. Iran is allowed under the law to have a nuclear energy program so long as it is declared and opened up to inspection. And they've done that. Now we have a situation where the Bush administration has to make a case for war about Iran's nuclear weapons program. One would think, with all the data that I just threw out there, this would be a very difficult case to make. A very difficult case to make. Especially in light of what occurred in Iraq. But ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you right now, the trap has already been set. The American public has been brainwashed. The American media does nothing more than parrot the president's case without challenging the president's case. And as the end result, the conclusion is all but assured. If you look at both the House and the Senate, when they discuss Iran today, they say that our policy must be one of confrontation with Iran to eliminate their nuclear energy program. Democrat and Republican alike speak about getting rid of the Iranian nuclear energy program. Why? It comes back to the same reason why no one wanted to speak out against the war in Iraq. You're either against me, you're either with me or against me. I need to hold Iran accountable. If you're against that, then you're on the side of Iran. And that's what's taking place today, ladies and gentlemen, this gross oversimplification where the President of the United States has perverted the very rule of law, the very notions of constitutionalism that make this country have the great potential that it does, in fact, possess. And we're letting them get away with it. We, the people of the United States of America, the same people that Abraham Lincoln alluded to in his speech at Gettysburg, where he said that this is government of the people, by the people, for the people. But we've stopped operating in that fashion. We've stopped operating in that fashion. There is no element of accountability that exists in this country anymore. And the proof of this is the fact that we still have in place the same cast of characters that lied us into a war in Iraq. And not only have we failed to hold them accountable for what they've done, and I'm not talking about the president alone, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about every member of Congress who voted for this war, Republican and Democrat alike. When people say, how do we get out of Iraq? I'll tell you how we get out of Iraq. Remember, this is not about national security. This is about domestic American politics. And right now, we have a Congress that is trapped by its own voting record. You will not have significant members of Congress and the Senate reverse their vote on Iraq. Their political careers depend on them defending the decision they made to go to war. So until which time we, the people of the United States, purge Congress of everyone who voted for that war and has yet to publicly refute or back away from that vote and say it was wrong. Until we purge every member of Congress, we're going to be in Iraq because we're never going to get out so long as Congress suffers the political fallout of that. It's not George Bush that we need to worry about today. He's the president. We got him for 3 more years. It's the Hillary Rodham Clintons. It's the Joe Bidens. It's the other people who think they want to be president and yet refuse to back away from the decision they made about Iraq. And these are the same people who will tell you that we need to confront Iran because of the clear and present risk posed by Iran's weapons of mass destruction programs. Ladies and gentlemen, it's fraudulent. It's a lie. It's wrong. You know, when a government official commits fraud in the course of his or her official duties, that's a felony. That fits the classic definition of high crimes and misdemeanors, language specific to the rule of law, which speaks about the case for impeachment. Now, it may not be viable to impeach the President of the United States of America, but what is viable is the vote, every son of a you-know-what that voted in favor of this war and sustaining the war effort against Iran out of office in 2006. You want a revolution in America? You got 1 year to start your revolution. The revolution in America needs to have its terminus November 2006, when we, the people of the United States of America, newly empowered with having the wool removed from our eyes by Hurricane Katrina, no longer believing at face value that this government in post-9/11 is actually working to secure our better interests. Vote out of office everyone who's gotten us into this sordid state of affairs and start putting people in office who represent the true will of the American people. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions anybody has.
You're listening to an address by former Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter, recorded September 17, 2005 in New Haven, Connecticut. Next up is a question and answer session with the audience.
During the presidential debates, surprisingly, Kerry slipped out something about 16 bases, permanent bases being built in Iraq. And that has, of course, been not mentioned in the media since, or... Aren't there those who feel that the post-war planning is unsustainable within the government, within the military, based on the example of Iraq? So isn't this an unsustainable policy? And aren't there people who perhaps have cooler heads that are standing up, or at least putting counter-arguments to the neocon vision of empire?
Okay. First thing about the bases, you know, we have over 120 bases in Iraq right now. The goal is to bring those down to around 40 and then shrink that down to, I believe, 14 is the number that they're working on right now. That's been since modified because the 14 are unsustainable given the security situation. You know, when the Bush administration now, their plan is 4 bases in Iraq, which will become giant military facilities that are away from the Iraqi people. Sort of self-governing zones. Why? Because Iraq is always seen as the lily pad from which we will move out and deal with Iran, we will deal with Syria, we will deal with other countries. So we plan on keeping people in Iraq, a significant number of people, 30 to 40,000 in bases. You know, the fact that the military still thinks this way when confronted with the fact that 98% of the Iraqi people want us out of their country, and that as long as American troops and British generals and American generals recognize today that as long as we're in Iraq, the insurgency will never end. That the main thing that keeps the insurgency going in Iraq today is the presence of American troops. And yet, having said that, they continue to articulate strategies which have a permanent presence of a significant number of American troops in Iraq. Now we move on to the second question. Don't evaluate the Bush administration's policies from a framework of international security or national security. It's about domestic politics. You say and I say that it's unsustainable from a national security perspective. But when you take a look at what occurred in 2004 and prior to that in 2000, we have a president who was elected by 17.6% of the eligible vote. That is not a majority. We have a president who has an administration that is heavily influenced by the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party. These are parasites who have attached themselves to a host vehicle, the Republican Party, and they don't want to lose power. And the only way this parasitical neoconservative movement can stay in power is to implement the national security strategy of the United States, written by neoconservatives in 1997. The national security strategy of the United States of America is Orwellian in its simplicity because it will give us permanent war. And when you have permanent war, you can now sell to the American constituency grossly oversimplified and I would say even incorrect perceptions of the world we live in, so that informed people are going crazy, but the majority of the American people are buying into the lie. And they've bought into the lie in Iraq. They're buying into the lie in Iran today. So until we can get the American people to understand what's going on here, I think that you and I are going to continue to be extremely frustrated by what we see as an unsustainable policy being sustained, because the fuel for its sustainability is not legitimate national security, but domestic American politics.
In order to even think on implementing an agenda for war with Iran, we would have to have a massive level of mobilization in this country, close to the level of mobilization that we had in World War II, because of the simple reason that Iran is a bigger country than Iraq. Iran has a larger population than Iraq. Iran is a totally different animal.
Once again, you've made a fatal mistake. You're thinking. Stop thinking. Stop evaluating Iran from the standpoint of legitimate concerns. Now become a neoconservative who understands that because Iran is a big country, we can't go to war with the resources available. So what do? You have to alter reality. And this is what they've done. How did they alter the reality of Iraq? We're going to be greeted with songs and flour. That's what they told the American people. They're going to greet us with songs and flour. The Iraqi people want democracy. We get rid of Saddam, they're going to rise up and embrace us, and everything's going to be great. What are they saying about Iran? That the Iranian people love democracy. That the Iranian people want to be democratic. All we have to do is to create the conditions that the mullahs collapse and the Iranian people will rise up and take matters in their own hand. That's why the war plan is currently planned. The one that's on the books right now doesn't talk about occupying Iran. It talks about bombing Iran, bombing them, hitting not only nuclear facilities, but hitting facilities related to the national command structure, decapitating the mullah's ability to contain the will of the people. And then the will of the people will express itself, rising up in the streets, throwing the mullahs out, and we don't need to occupy Iran anymore. That's the thinking that's going on in Washington, D.C. I'm not making this up. They actually believe this stuff. But the military understands that this is stupid. See, the military knows that there's no case study in history that shows that when you bomb a people, they rise up and embrace those who bomb them. Doesn't happen.
They don't.
So the military says we have to take it to the next level. We're going to bomb and we're going to weaken. But what we have to do is put boots on the ground. We can't occupy Iran, but we can shoot up a presence to the outskirts of Tehran. From where? Azerbaijan. That's why over the last 2 years, Donald Rumsfeld spent an inordinate amount of time in Azerbaijan. If you take a look at the deployment of American National Guard and Reserve construction units, they're in Azerbaijan right now building airfields, building massive facilities to support a force of 2 to 4 divisions. That is not a massive mobilization. We can churn out 2 to 4 divisions to Azerbaijan to make the short leap up or across the Caspian Sea coastline to the outskirts of Tehran, where we sit putting pressure on the Iranian government, which will collapse as the Iranian people rise up. But now the military is saying this is tough, because if we do that, we can't sustain it. We don't like to shoot 4 divisions out there with reserves, and we don't have any reserves. Mm-hmm. So what has Dick Cheney now told the military? Start planning for the preemptive use of nuclear weapons. The whole new thinking in the United States today about nuclear weapons, where we have a new category of weapons the Bush administration built, usable nukes. That's a neat term because it means usable. They're going to use them. Now we have a doctrine on how we're going to use them, preemptively in a non-nuclear environment. That's the new doctrine. So we talk about Iran today. I'm telling you exactly how I feel this war is going to go. Major aerial campaign that has little or no effect, followed by a limited ground campaign that will stall, followed by the unilateral use of nuclear weapons by the United States of America. And I have no clue what's going to happen after that because we already are in nightmare scenario.
Since specifically 9/11, there seems to be a huge growth of youth taking an interest in politics and global dynamics and everything associated with that. Just recalling from memory, I believe I had read that you're a father.
I am a father, yeah.
What would your advice be for the youth out there that are starting to get involved in this? What kind of logical steps could we take to stop this from happening, continuing in the future? Because as you just said, you can't do anything about a problem unless you define it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the youth are being able to define it. What kind of steps do we take to stop this?
For too long now, when you're in high school, you're told to look up to your elders, and they're going to define the problem for you. Your elders are going to give you the problem. They're going to help train you for the solution. And what I tell people is my generation has failed your generation. We have dropped the ball. We have not only failed to define the problem, we've created a whole host of new problems. Stop looking to us for the solution. I apologize, but we've ruined your adult life because you're not going to be able to fall back into this self-deceptive sea of economic prosperity that we had. You're confronting a world that's a more dangerous place. You're confronting an America that's being exposed as somewhat fraudulent. If you scrape off the scab of white middle-class America from every city, not just New Orleans, you will find underneath it a festering cesspool of racial inequity and poverty, primarily among black people and Hispanic people and people that aren't white. That's the reality of America. That's the America that you've inherited, and we broke it. You got to fix it. And I put the challenge right there because there's no way to sugarcoat it. You just confront them with the challenge. And then what I tell them is that I have twin 12-year-old daughters that I've condemned to this future. And if they and you and others don't stand up and take the lead in fixing it, just imagine how bad the world's going to be when you have 12-year-old daughters or sons. And if that can't motivate you to become active, I don't know what can, because if you can't transfer a better world to your children, then you have failed. And I'm telling you right now, we have not transferred. People of my generation have not transferred a better world to our children. We've transferred to them a world that is so much worse off than the one we inherited from our parents.
Thank you.
You have just heard an address by former Marine Intelligence Officer and UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. The talk, titled Parallel Deceptions, the Bush Agenda for War in Iraq and Iran, was recorded at the United Church on the Green in New Haven, Connecticut on September the 17th, 2005, an event sponsored by Squeaky Wheel Productions. To order a video DVD or audio CD copy of this program, call area code 203-268-8446 or visit our website at www.squeakywheel.net and specify that you're ordering a video or audio copy of Scott Ritter's Parallel Deceptions talk. Again, for information on how to order this program in video DVD or audio CD format, call 203-268-8446 or visit our website at www.squeakywheel.net. Mail orders can be sent to Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. This program was produced by Scott Harris in association with Walter Wagoner and the volunteers at Squeaky Wheel Productions, distributors of the nationally syndicated Between the Lines weekly radio news magazine. Download or podcast new and archived Between the Lines programs on the web at www.btlonline.org. For Squeaky Wheel Productions, I'm Prue Cullen.